Starting something new is always scary, whether it's a new job, a new school, a new band, a new podcast. It's exciting, don't get me wrong, but it's still a little scary. If you're in a band, at least you have other people with you, people who have your back when you're struggling, or people you can blame when you fail. But if you're going solo, everything falls on you. This is the first episode of a podcast I'm calling Good Measure. And I thought, what better theme for the first episode than stories of artists going solo? This is a common story in music history. Seems like a lot of times, as soon as a band gets popular, the members can't wait to go and have their own solo album. And often we see people from successful bands become successful solo artists. Harry Styles from One Direction, Lionel Richie from The Commodores. I don't know why those are the first two examples I thought of, but what's a little more rare is seeing somebody whose band was unsuccessful then become a successful solo act. Today we've got three stories. The bass player of a moderately successful indie rock band who became one of the most popular artists in a completely different genre of music years later. We're talking about one of the members of a girl group who looked like she might be a successful songwriter but never make it as an artist on her own. And finally, we're talking about a solo musician who was reluctant to even release his music, but he started his solo career while he was still in a band, and the solo work overshadowed the band so much that they broke up. And he went on to great success as a solo artist, but also great tragedy. Today, the ups and downs of going solo.
What keeps us together?
It's been written that Quentin Cook is in the Guinness Book of World Records as the artist who's had the most hits under different names. It's unclear if this is actually a record or one that he just joked he probably would own. But his is a name that you would definitely recognize, just probably not by his birth name. Quentin was raised in Surrey, England, which he described as a suburban hellhole. His mother was a teacher and his father was an environmental consultant. He actually is credited with bringing bottle banks to the UK. Which, as an American, I think I understand to be something to do with recycling. When Quentin is 14, his older brother brings home the first album by the legendary UK punk band The Damned, just called Damn Damn Damned. And Quentin is instantly hooked on punk rock. Here was music, he said, that seemed like it was rewriting all the rules.
You're allowed to have a bash at anything. You know, here's a guitar, form a band.
He played in a local band called Disc Attack, first as the drummer and then as the lead vocalist. Then through the music scene, he met another young musician named Paul Heaton. They formed a band together called the Stomping Frogs. But when he was 18 and it was time to go to university, Quentin moved to Brighton and enrolled at Brighton Polytechnic University. Quentin still loved punk rock, but he was also starting to get exposed to a new type of music from America, hip-hop from New York City. His favorite punk band, The Clash, was incorporating hip-hop into their music, and Quentin was falling in love with DJs like Afrika Bambaataa and Grandmaster Flash. He took his record collection and started putting on block parties in Brighton that were meant to recreate the block parties of New York.
I've always said the biggest influences in my life were probably The Clash and Grandmaster Flash. The minute I heard Adventures on the Wheels of Steel, I'm like, this is what music should sound like. This is how it should go.
He dubbed himself DJ Quentox, the ox that rocks. He worked with this MC named DJ Baptiste. DJ was actually his initials. He wasn't a DJ, he was an MC. It was kind of confusing. Then, in 1985, Quentin got a call from his old friend Paul Heaton. Paul had started a band in Hull with another guy named Stan Cullimore. They were just about to go on a big tour, and their bass player had quit. So Paul asked Quentin if he would join his band, the House Martins.
The House Martins was a kind of hark back to my youth. Paul Heaton, I'd been in bands with him when we were at school in Red Hill. And he moved up to Hull and I moved down to Brighton, but we kept in touch. But in those days, I kind of felt that being a suburban white kid in England, I felt my role in life was to be in a suburban white pop group.
Quentin joins on bass at the end of 1985, and the band pretty quickly becomes one of the more successful bands in the British indie scene. Along with bands like The Smiths in Manchester, the House Martins are on the other coast, playing a kind of jangly indie pop. They have smart, social, political, satirical lyrics, and also a knack for writing great hooks. They're a favorite of the popular DJ John Peel and do several sessions with him. Then in 1986, they put out a single called Happy Hour that went to number 3 on the UK singles chart.
What a good place to be. Don't believe that.
They put out a music video for the single that was done in claymation, which helped the popularity of the single. Later that year, they released their debut album, which was called London Zero Hull 4. This was kind of an inside joke. It was written as a football score. Paul Heaton often joked that the House Martins were the fourth best band in Hull, after Red Guitars, The Gargoyles, and the band Everything But The Girl, who actually would have a hit with the song Missing a few years later. The album did pretty well in the UK and in Canada, but didn't make much of an impact anywhere else. In December of 1986, the band had their biggest hit yet. When they were doing the John Peel sessions, they had done a cover of this song, Caravan of Love. Sometimes this song is credited as being an Isley Brothers song, but that's technically not true. The Isley Brothers had started as a vocal trio of brothers back in the 1950s, and in the 1970s, two of their younger brothers, along with their brother-in-law, had joined the band. Sometimes that was called the Isley Brothers 3 plus 3. But those two younger brothers and the brother-in-law, whose last name was Jasper, actually started a splinter group that was called Isley Jasper Isley, and that's the band that recorded Caravan of Love. That song came out in 1985 and did okay, but the House Martins did an a cappella cover of it, and that single actually went to number one in the UK.
Every woman, every man, join the caravan of love.
Stand up,
stand up, stand up. Everybody take a stand, join the caravan of love.
Stand up,
stand up, stand up. I'm your brother.
It has the distinction of only being the second song ever to top the UK charts that was a cappella. The first was actually a song by this group called The Flying Pickets that actually came out a couple years earlier. There's something about a cappella in the UK in the 80s that was big. The House Martins followed up their number one single with their second album in 1987 called The People Who Grinned Themselves to Death. That album did okay, but again, for the most part, they were a UK-only phenomenon. And then, in 1988, the band broke up. Quentin said that when the band broke up, he felt part relief and part devastation. He was relieved because he didn't really want to be playing that kind of music anymore. He wanted to go back to the hip-hop DJing he was doing before he joined the House Martins, and also get in on the emerging dance music scene in the UK.
And so all my old mates, like Cold Cut and everyone, started putting records out and getting in the charts, and that's why I left the House Martins, because I was like, no, this is the music I love, this is what I want to do, I don't want to be in a pop band.
But he was also scared that he might have to go get a real job. In 1989, he put out a song that was closer to the dance music that he wanted to do. It was called Blame It on the Bassline. He put it out under the name that he had actually taken when he joined the House Martins. He said he never liked the name Quentin, and people made fun of him about it. So for some reason, he changed his name to Norman. An interviewer once asked him why he thought Norman was better than Quentin, and he said, well, I was going to be Ernie, but I thought Norman suited me better.
Them when hurts from 50 down to 10, 90 kilohertz. Only heard by Alsatians, boosted by graphic equalizations. I'm described as eclectic, backed up by parametric. Engineers worry about the
thing. That song, Blame It on the Bassline, was put out as Norman Cook featuring MC Wildski, and the song actually went to number 29 on the UK charts.
Both musically and image wise, it couldn't really be further removed from the House Martins, could it?
The who? Oh, the House Martins. I thought you weren't going to mention the House Martins. No, yeah, I suppose not. I suppose it's not really a change of direction for me, because for me, like, joining the House Martins was a change of direction, because I was a DJ before, I was a nightclub DJ. And so basically I'm going back to what I did before and going back to dressing how I did before. Whereas, you see, when I joined the House Martins, they made me throw away all my fashionable clothes, and they made me wear horrible cardigans.
But Norman wasn't done going through name transformations. After this, he decided that he wanted to put together a collective of like-minded DJs and MCs, people in the dance and hip-hop music scenes, and he called it Beats International. Beats International put out an album in 1990 called Let Them Eat Bingo, and the big single off this record was a song called Dub Be Good to Me. This album also hit the UK charts, but unfortunately got Norman some unwanted attention. He hadn't bothered clearing any of the samples in the song, and it used samples from The Clash's Guns of Brixton, and also took a lot from a song called Just Be Good to Me by this band called the SOS Band. It was a song written by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. Norman tried to fight it in court, but ended up losing, and had to pay back twice as much as he actually made in royalties from the song, and he went bankrupt. But he wasn't done putting out music. In 1994, he was part of a project called Freak Power that put out an album with the delightful name Drive Through Booty. This project also yielded a hit. He had a hit with a song called Turn On, Tune In, Cop Out.
Some people been driving too fast. Some people still having a gas.
The song was later used for a multi-million dollar Levi's commercial. Then in 1995, Norman took on the name Pizza Man and put out an album called Pizza Mania. And if you're like me, you're thinking, I've never heard of any of these groups. Pizza Man also had three top 40 UK hits. Somehow everything Norman touched reached the charts. But it wasn't until his next project that he became an actual worldwide sensation. In 1996, he adopted yet another pseudonym. This time it was a name that sounded like the name of a fake blues singer. He said later he couldn't remember how he came up with it, it just sounded like a cool oxymoronic phrase. He started calling himself Fatboy Slim.
And then I had another alter ego called Fatboy Slim, which just devoured the rest of them. Just ate the rest of them and spat them out. After being in the music business by then about 15 years, I kind of thought I'd seen everything and done everything. But when the Fatboy Slim big beat thing took off, it just kind of went up a pace, you know, having a number one single to having a number one album. And yeah, my life kind of changed in a way that I could never go back to being like this sort of DJ who hid under different aliases. And I kind of got outed and there was sort of no going back.
His first Fatboy Slim album, Better Living Through Chemistry, was again a hit in the UK. But then in June of 1998, he released the song that would become his big commercial breakthrough. It was again built through samples, although this time he cleared them properly. Notably, the song Sliced Tomatoes by the Just Brothers. An old funk song from the 70s. But most famously, he took a line from the rapper Lord Finesse, but not that he rapped, that he did in a spoken intro to a kind of obscure album by a group called the Vinyl Dogs.
Check it out right about now. It's no other than the funk soul brother, the Lord Finesse. And you're welcome to the world of the Vinyl Dogs right about now. So if you're digging, peep how we do it like this.
Originally it was the Lord Finesse introducing the tracks of Vinyl Dogs, which was just an album of breakbeats. But he wasn't saying any kind of rhythm. So I thought, I could just hear right about now. Funk brother. So I chopped it up.
Right about now, the funk soul brother.
So each syllable you add.
Each syllable, yeah. And yeah, put it all together and it sounds like this.
Right about now.
Though I'm using a collage of samples, I try and work like you would a pop song. Having been in a pop band previously in the House Martins, I've used a song structure, and you know, verse, chorus, middle, eight. And so I would try and treat one bit as the verse and one as the chorus. Whereas a lot of people making dance music, it's just like it's sort of one linear thing. But I tried to make them shaped and feel like pop records with pop structure, but most importantly, the hook. You know, once you've got the hook and the rhythm, then the rest of it is just filling in the dots. So they're the two important things. And if you haven't got them, you haven't really got a song.
This song, The Rockefeller Skank, became a huge hit, including in the US. In October of 1998, he put out his second Fatboy Slim album, You've Come a Long Way, Baby. This album included the UK number one and the US top 40 song Praise You, and the album went quadruple platinum. This album hit at just the right time as dance music was starting to hit in the US. Fatboy Slim, along with groups like Prodigy and Basement Jaxx, Groove Armada, Chemical Brothers, became prominent artists in the big beat movement. Fatboy Slim's catchy, accessible dance music along with iconic videos made by Spike Jonze, made him one of the biggest stars of the 90s, which seemed pretty unlikely for a DJ in his mid-30s who had been the bass player in an indie rock band. After the House Martins, Fatboy Slim's old friend Paul Heaton went on to another group called The Beautiful South, that also were pretty successful in the UK and sold something like 15 million records. He then went on to a solo career of his own. Every once in a while, people will ask Fatboy Slim if the House Martins will ever reunite. He usually jokes that they'll get back together when the Smiths do. But Fatboy Slim also said they wouldn't do it because they made a pact. He said in 1988 they were all in a hotel together in Dublin, and they said, "This is it. The band's breaking up." And they all agreed that it was for the best. The members of the House Martins got to go on to make the kind of music that they wanted to make. And for Fatboy Slim, that was music that the whole world wanted to hear. Our second story starts off in a place in the United States that's not talked about enough in music history, Southeast Virginia. In the 1990s and 2000s, radio was dominated by a group of artists and producers that all came from this area, and one of the most important was a girl named Melissa. Melissa said that she remembered in kindergarten, her teacher would go around asking all the students, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And everybody would say, "A lawyer, a doctor," until they got to Melissa, and she would say, "A superstar." She said everybody would laugh at her, but every Friday, they would ask the same question, she would give the same answer. Melissa later would be known as the class clown and was worried that people wouldn't take her seriously. But she was serious about becoming a superstar.
I tell this story over and over again. I used to take like my baby Elias, all my doll babies, and sit them up against the wall and imagine that they were screaming for me. And I would just get louder and louder. And in my mind, I just seen them clapping. And my mother would come in there and she wouldn't even bother me because she knew I was like on stage or something.
She grew up in a musical house. She said her father was always playing R&B. Her mother was always playing gospel. So she got the best of both worlds.
I think I learned harmonies by listening to the gospel. I think I learned feeling by listening to the gospel. Something about gospel music just has a conviction when you hear the singers. The R&B side, there was a sauce that I learned from that. And lyrical content, love, you know, heartache, what's going on in the world.
She idolized the pop stars that she saw growing up on TV, Janet Jackson, Michael Jackson. She said she would look in the mirror and imagining herself being on stage, accepting an award, thanking Madonna for working with her on her newest song. But not only was music her dream, it was also her escape. Growing up, her father was abusive and violent.
I never asked why my father beat my mother. I never asked him. I was very close to my mother, very attached to my mother. And my father never hit me, but I felt like him hitting my mother was like hitting me.
And one day when she was young, her mother took her and ran away.
We left him with a fork, a spoon, a plate, and a blanket. And that was all that was in the house. I thought my father would go to her job and try to hurt her, but it was a blessing that he didn't, and he found it in his heart to kind of move on with his life.
Despite her devastating home life, Melissa was a brilliant student. She took an IQ test in the second grade and tested so high that she skipped two grades. But then she felt so socially isolated from her peers that she deliberately failed so she could move back. After high school, her mother wanted her to join the army, but Melissa knew that for her, it was music or nothing. In 1991, Melissa started a group with her friends Chinita, LaShawn, and Radaya. They called themselves FaZe, but spelled it F-A-Y-Z-E. And one day, Jodeci were having a show. And FaZe managed to get themselves backstage and do an impromptu audition for the members of Jodeci. They sang for Devante Swing, who was the de facto leader of Jodeci. At the time, he had his own imprint through Elektra Records called Swing Mob. He agreed to sign FaZe to his label, but they had to move to New York and move into a two-bedroom house that they would share with 20 other aspiring musicians, all artists that were signed to Swing Mob that were affectionately called the Basement Crew. When she got there, Melissa told Devante that he had to bring in two of her friends to also be part of Swing Mob. One was a rapper and one was a DJ and producer who would actually produce the first FaZe demo. She kept pushing until Devante finally gave in and her two friends came and moved to New York too. The rapper was named Melvin Barcliff, who went by the name Magoo. He had also given Melissa her nickname. He had said it should be illegal for one person to have so much talent, so he called her Missy Misdemeanor Elliott. And the DJ was Tim Mosley, who had been known around Virginia as DJ Timmy Tim. But when he got to the Swing Mob House, Devante gave him a nickname based on the popular boots and called him Timbaland.
I kept telling him, hey, you know, I got this guy and he does all of our music. And I'm telling you, he is amazing. And I said, please, please, you know, bring him up here. Can I please bring him up here? I begged and begged until he finally bought Tim. And then once Tim came, I said, hey, I got another friend. His name is Magoo. I promise he is so dope. He was like, you're not going to bring everybody from Virginia.
Devante had also renamed FaZe. By this time, they were being called Sista. And Missy Elliott kept telling him that she wanted Timbaland to produce their first album. Devante said, no, I'm going to be producing the album. But he quickly recognized Timbaland's skill. The artists in the Swing Mob House all worked together on each other's projects. They worked on songs for Jodeci. In 1993, Missy Elliott actually wrote the debut single for the actress Raven Simone, called That's What Little Girls Are Made Of. And then finally, in 1994, Sista was going to release their debut album. It was called For All the Sistas Around the World. It was produced by Devante Swing and Timbaland, but after it was released in September of 1994, it did so poorly that they shelved the album.
Sista.
The next thing you knew, Swing Mob's deal with Elektra Records fell through, and Sista's deal fell apart too. But Sylvia Roan, one of the executives at Elektra, recognized Missy Elliott's talent, so even though Sista was dropped, she signed Missy as a solo act. Missy loved being part of a group and hadn't really considered being a solo artist. And in fact, it would be years before she would make her debut. In the meantime, her and Timbaland kept working together and formed a songwriting and production partnership.
Me and Timbaland's relationship is special because he's the only one that understands me, and I think I'm the only one that understands him. We're both, I think, put here in this industry to change the radio. And that's why we click so good, because we know that, like, the radio is stuck right now. Everything sound the same. As far as video-wise, everything looked the same. So we feel like we're coming in and we're going to change the whole thing.
They wrote and produced songs for some of the other artists that had been part of that Swing Mob House. Artists like Ginuwine, Playa, and Tweet. They wrote songs for Total and Destiny's Child. And then they got their big breakthrough when they worked on Aaliyah's second album. They wrote and produced 9 songs with her, including the title track of her album, One in a Million.
Wow. Much love to my crew, Timbaland. I've seen everybody.
Did a record called Sugar and Spice that Timbaland and another young man took into Atlantic Records. They liked the sound, and it was something different they had never heard before. So they said, you know, Let's put y'all in the studio with Aaliyah. And we was excited.
I gotta thank her because she heard the specialness in us.
Right.
Because when Sugar Spice, she's like, there's something special about Tim and Missy.
The album went double platinum, and Missy Elliott and Timbaland became two of the most sought-after songwriters and producers overnight. But rather than keep on working for other people, they decided the time was right for Missy Elliott to debut as a solo artist. They started working on an album that would become Supa Dupa Fly, and they gave themselves all sorts of rules. They weren't allowed to listen to any other music, so they wouldn't be trying to chase any trends or know what was popular at the time.
It's the way we've been brought up. Mm-hmm. You know, we were under Devante, who taught us that, but that ended up being a good thing because if you don't see or you don't hear, you don't end up copying or mimicking something else. We had to create our own sound.
Timbaland was already getting a reputation for bringing all sorts of avant-garde, interesting sounds and futuristic production into hip-hop, and he did some of his best work on this album. Missy's debut single came out in the summer of 1997, called The Rain.
When the rain hits my window, I take it.
The iconic video, directed by Hype Williams, came out June 3rd, 1997. And Supa Dupa Fly, the album, came out in July. The world had never seen anything or heard anything like Missy Elliott before. She became one of the first female rappers to break into the mainstream. And she continued to follow up Supa Dupa Fly with work that proved it wasn't a fluke. She had huge smash singles like Get Your Freak On and Work It, and all six of her solo albums have gone platinum, the most out of any female rapper. She's also the only female MC to be inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and she's influenced a whole new generation of artists. Musicians like Cardi B, Doja Cat, Janelle Monáe, Little Sims, and Lizzo have all cited Missy Elliott as an inspiration. In a recent interview with another mega producer, Rick Rubin, Missy recalled that time sitting in kindergarten when, every Friday, without fail, she would answer, "I want to be a superstar when I grow up." She said she said it every Friday, and every Friday, all the kids in class would laugh at her. She said she thinks back on that and thinks, "I wonder if they remember me," because I definitely remember all of them. This next artist doesn't have a ton in common musically with the previous two, but there are overlaps in their stories. Like Fatboy Slim's mom, Stephen Paul Smith's mom was also a teacher. She was a music teacher. And unfortunately, like Missy Elliott, he also grew up in a traumatic, abusive household. Stephen was born in Omaha, Nebraska in 1969, but his parents split up when he was 6 months old and he went to live with his mother in Texas. His mother remarried and Stephen had a troubled relationship with his stepfather. Stephen has claimed that he was abusive and has written songs about him, but it should be pointed out that the stepfather has denied these allegations. Stephen started playing the piano at 9, and when he was 10, he entered a piece that he had written in this local arts festival and won. It was a song called Fantasy. That year, he also got an acoustic guitar and started playing that.
I liked Kiss and the Beatles, and wanted to be in Kiss and the Beatles, and that's why I started playing guitar.
When he was 14, he finally escaped from Texas and his stepfather's home. Later, he actually got a tattoo of the state of Texas, which he said wasn't because he was proud to be from there, but it was kind of a reminder of what he had gotten away from. His biological father had relocated to Portland, Oregon, and was working as a psychiatrist, and Stephen moved in with him. Unfortunately, this didn't solve all of Stephen's problems. He started experimenting with alcohol and drugs, but he also got even further into music. He played clarinet in his high school band, and he also started his own rock bands, bands like Stranger Than Fiction and A Murder of Crows. After he graduated from Lincoln High School in Portland, he decided that Stephen didn't really suit him as a name. He thought Stephen sounded too bookish, but Steve sounded like a jock's name. Also, Steve Smith was the name of the drummer from Journey, so he started calling himself Elliot Smith. People have suggested that he might have taken the name from an Elliot Avenue that was in Portland. After high school, the newly named Elliot Smith moved to Amherst, Massachusetts, to attend Hampshire College. He went there following a girlfriend, but they actually broke up before college even started. But still, he stuck with it. He double majored in philosophy and political science. And in 1987, he met another student there who would become his musical partner for the next almost decade, a guy named Neil Gust. They formed a band in college called Swimming Jesus and would do Elvis Costello covers.
In college, with me and Elliot, we bonded straight away over music, and I think we started playing together and recording stuff almost immediately. What we bonded over was that we'd both done recording in high school, and we both really loved Elvis Costello. And then we ended up discovering music at the same time, like the Pixies and Fugazi.
But after they graduated, they went back to Portland and started a new band, a band that they would call Heat Miser. They got a drummer named Tony Lash that Elliot had actually played with back in their high school band. Lash had played the flute in the high school band and also played drums in Elliot's band Stranger Than Fiction. They had bonded over their love of the band Rush. Heat Miser made their live debut on Valentine's Day 1992 at a place called the X-Ray Cafe in Portland. Elliot and Neil both played guitar, wrote songs, and sang in the band. They were also roommates, and some people speculated that they were lovers, although Elliot Smith denied this. Neil Gust was openly gay and would sing songs about gay themes, and sometimes Heat Miser would get lumped in with queercore. They both worked odd jobs around Portland to support themselves. Elliot Smith worked in a bakery, which he thought was kind of funny since he had 2 degrees, but music was his real passion and he didn't really want to do anything else. At one point, he got laid off from the bakery and went on unemployment, which Neil likened to getting a grant from the state to just record music. He started recording solo acoustic songs on a 4-track recorder in his house. Heat Miser started doing well locally. They put out an album on Frontier Records called Dead Air in 1993. But Elliot was still making all these home solo recordings, and his girlfriend at the time, JJ Gonson, encouraged him to submit it to a record label. He was reluctant at first, but agreed to send it to this label called Cavity Search. They were a local Portland label who had put out some Heat Miser singles, and he thought maybe he could do a 7-inch with them as a solo artist. But Cavity Search loved the home recording so much that they asked, can we just put this out as an album as is? They called the album Roman Candle, and it came out in July of 1994.
Played himself, didn't need me to give him hell.
Elliot Smith thought for sure that this was a bad idea. This was still the height of grunge and loud rock and roll, and this was a lo-fi folk acoustic album. He thought he had to keep going with his more conventional rock band Heat Miser. They also put out an album in 94 called Cop and Speeder. But Elliot Smith's solo acoustic stuff almost immediately started to eclipse the work he was doing with his band. In 95, he got scooped up by a bigger indie label, Kill Rock Stars, and put out a self-titled album. He was starting to build serious momentum, and it was also causing a lot of tension in the band. When he would do interviews for his solo stuff, he was dismissive of the work he was doing with his band, and it seemed like only a matter of time before the band would split up. But then Heat Miser actually signed to a major label. They signed with Virgin Records. But just when it seemed like the band might blow up, they broke up. They put out a final album, Mike City Sons, in 1996, but then Elliot Smith concentrated on his solo career.
Now, you used to be in a band called Heat Miser.
Yeah.
So what's the big advantage of being a solo artist now?
Well, four men in a band is... anything else is preferable to that.
Don't you miss the encouragement of...
Yeah, sort of, but we didn't always get along too well, so... And it's also nice not to have to carry around a bunch of heavy crap, you know?
In 1997, he put out his third record called Either Or. This album was his most critically acclaimed yet.
So you played all the instruments on your latest album, Either Or, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel that you enjoy having all the control like that, or do you actually like sharing the responsibility a little bit with other musicians and collaborators?
I don't know. I just do it myself because I like to play different instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't get better at things you never play.
But the most important thing that came from it was that the director, Gus Van Sant, was a big fan of it. Gus actually lived in Portland, so he knew Elliot Smith from the scene there. But when he heard Either Or, he thought the songs on it would be perfect for his new movie that he was directing called Good Will Hunting.
Do you like apples?
Yeah.
Well, I got a number. How do you like them apples?
The Good Will Hunting soundtrack used three songs from Either Or plus a song from an earlier record, and plus one song that hadn't been released yet. It wasn't actually written for the movie, it had already been recorded, but Elliot played it for Gus and he liked it, and the song Miss Misery ended up in the movie. And then it ended up getting nominated for an Academy Award.
Who would think that I was going to be nominated for an Oscar? I mean, that's, you know, it's preposterous.
The 70th Annual Academy Awards were occurring on March 23rd, 1998. And they asked Elliot Smith to perform his song Miss Misery there. And he said, no, I don't want to do that. So the producers told him, that's fine, we'll just have somebody else perform your song for you. And he didn't like the idea of somebody else singing his song, so he agreed to do it. He got on stage in a white suit, very unassumingly, and played a shortened version of his small little acoustic song.
Nothing to do. Do you miss me? Like you say you do.
Later that night, he would lose the award for best song to My Heart Will Go On from Titanic.
From Good Will Hunting, Miss Misery, music and lyrics by Elliot Smith. And from Titanic, My Heart Will Go On, music by James Horner and lyrics by Will Jennings. And the Oscar goes to What a shocker. And the Oscar goes to James Horner and Will Jennings for My Heart Will Go On.
Elliot Smith described this Oscar experience as surreal.
So Elliot, last time I saw you, it was like last summer. Mm-hmm. You played to about 40 people in the Rivoli in Toronto.
Right.
And working musician, and then boom. Some months pass, and I'm watching the TV, and there you are holding hands with Celine Dion and Trisha Yearwood on the Academy Awards. What happened?
I wish I could say. It was really weird. I mean, they were nice people. They were both really nice. And it was really bizarre.
But things kept snowballing from there. He signed with a major label, DreamWorks, and there was more attention and pressure on him than ever before. He started to seriously struggle with drug abuse, depression, suicidal thoughts. There was an accident where he fell off a cliff and injured himself that some people suspected might have been a suicide attempt. But he continued to pour himself into his music. In August of 1998, his album EXO was released, and then in 2000, the album Figure Eight. He wasn't necessarily a megastar, he wasn't selling millions and millions of albums, but he had a very dedicated, loyal fan base and a lot of critical acclaim. But he was continuing to unravel. He was addicted to heroin, then to crack cocaine. He would have embarrassing public performances where he would forget the words to his songs. He had interventions from friends, he had attempts at rehab, but nothing seemed to be working. And then on his 34th birthday, August 6, 2003, he finally had a breakthrough at getting sober. He quit drugs, he quit alcohol, he also quit red meat and sugar. But then on October 21st, 2003, he was dead. His girlfriend that he lived with at the time said that they had gotten in an argument, she had locked herself in the bathroom, then she heard a scream, and when she came out, she found a knife plunged into Elliot's chest. He had been stabbed 2 times. He was rushed to the hospital, but it was too late. There was a note left behind that could have been interpreted as a suicide note. It just said, "I'm so sorry, love Elliot, God forgive me." Officially, the death remains unsolved. He didn't have any of what they call hesitation wounds, which usually occur when someone is stabbing themselves. And when the toxicology report came back, he didn't have any alcohol or any illegal substances in his body. Just some prescription antidepressants and ADD medication.
These songs are kind of melancholy. There's a sorrowful quality to Elliot Smith's music.
Yeah, I mean, they don't make me sad or feel sorrowful to me. But, I mean, on the other hand, I'm not... A lot of people are kind of depressed. I mean, I'm happy some of the time, and some of the time I'm not. But yeah, there's like just certain songs just feel a way that's hard to put into words, and it's not happy, and it's also not really sad. But I couldn't say what it is.
Elliot Smith lived his life with a lot of pain. But luckily for all of us, he was able to translate that pain into a lot of amazing music before he died. And one final thought for good measure. When I was thinking about what artists to do for this episode, I was wondering if Lou Reed would fit. The Velvet Underground were not commercially successful while they were around. Their legacy grew after they broke up. There's the famous Brian Eno quote that their first album only sold 40,000 copies, but everyone who bought a copy started their own band. The first commercial success that Lou Reed actually saw was on his second solo album, Transformer, which was produced by David Bowie. That yielded the worldwide hit Walk on the Wild Side. That one song was more commercially successful than anything the Velvet Underground had ever done. But if you think about what music was more important, I think most people would point to the Velvet Underground. So was Lou Reed a successful solo artist that came from an unsuccessful band? I guess it depends on how you define success.
Some words said in passing, the entire world crashing down again. That it's over, but then it goes on and on.
I'm Patrick Hicks. This has been Good Measure. Thank you so much for listening. I want to thank Brian Ishiba for doing the theme song for this podcast. Very special thanks to my wife Ellie, without whom this podcast would definitely not be possible. Nothing is really truly a solo effort. Everybody gets some help along the way. So thank you everybody for listening, and we'll see you next week.